Scrolling for May 13th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back again with our daily podcast, episode 49 of the Pam and the Two Schmucks show. And this time we are going through the adventure of the six Napoleons. Again, this is not a dessert, right?
It's not a dessert. And Steve, I think we're too tall to be a Napoleon.
Tall Napoleons. Pam and the Tall Napoleons. That is the name of our show.
Right.
So where do we start with this one, Pam?
Well, did this remind you guys of the Blue Carbuncle?
Yes.
Yeah, sort of.
It had that same wild goose feeling of looking for, you know, an object, and inside of it was a precious gem. It's sort of, you know, has the same kind of structure, I think.
Yeah, but you said wild goose chase. That was really a
goose. I know.
There's no goose in this story.
A wild dictator chase. Here we go. But I think the really important difference between that sixth short story and this 31st short story is that here we do have a murder. And you guys, it's been a long time since we've had a case without a murder. So we are now firmly into 20th century detective fiction, where we do get that shift from puzzles and oddities to, I mean, murder is just the baseline for detective fiction in the 20th century. And in fact, we're getting closer and closer to serial murder, not something that Doyle ever gets into, but we're moving in that direction.
And that's interesting that that's being brought up, because I'm not really sure that a murder was even needed for this story.
Exactly, right? It wasn't needed narratively, but I think it was needed generically within the genre of 20th century detective fiction.
Yeah. Gotta stay current.
We have moved from the basic puzzle mysteries to more crimes and more murders as these stories have matured.
That's because of video games. They introduced them at that time, and they had a huge.
You know what, though? Okay, you're making a joke, but all of the debates around video games from the 1980s were 100% happening 100 years earlier in the 1880s around dime novels and penny dreadfuls. And it's so interesting. I did this study comparing the actual rhetorical strategies. They're identical. The arguments that are made, the dangers of dime novels, the dangers of video games, like failing to see reality, being obsessed with murder and mayhem, they're exactly the same arguments.
Interesting.
And it sounds like it maybe it's something even to do with one group of people looking down on another one for enjoying, I don't know, the entertainment of the day.
Well, and age is a huge part of it, right? So a group of parent age or middle-aged people thinking, oh dear, the generation right behind us is not going to be as, you know, fill in your adjective, as wonderful as us because of this new technology that's going to absolutely destroy them. If you and I, in English, we know those same arguments have been made around grammar. Mm-hmm. Centuries, right? The kids today don't know grammar. You and I have said it. Our parents said it. Their parents said it. People said it in the 16th century.
Right. Language changes and entertainment mm-hmm. changes. And we have here that difference maybe between these matured stories versus the playful stories of, what are we talking, almost a decade previous when Doyle wrote the beginnings of these, right?
Sure.
Oh, 15 years earlier, right? Wow. This is 1984, and our first ones were late 1880s. But there's something very playful about this story, I think.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Pam, seriously, are there really hundreds of statues of Napoleon in London? This seems ridiculous, doesn't it?
The English love the French. That's what I would say.
Don't?
I mean, I have no idea. I just thought that was a hilarious detail as well.
The quote is, considering how many hundreds of statues of the great emperor must exist in London, it is too much to suppose such a coincidence as that promiscuous iconoclast should chance to begin upon three specimens of the same bust. That's where we're starting with this mystery. There's hundreds? Seriously?
Okay, but the point that, you know, if you're like obsessed with busts of Napoleon, you're not going to immediately start with three identical ones. I mean, that's a legit point. You know, statistically, there are more than three busts of London, of Napoleon in London. Hundreds? I mean, I don't know. I haven't done a study of such things.
All right. So I did a little Googling here. And I found that Napoleon Bonaparte was so famous because he arose from obscurity during the French Revolution and wound up defeating or controlling most of Europe. Mm-hmm. Europe and the world were changed forever on account of his reforms, mistakes, battles, victories, changes, and crimes. We do know the name Napoleon because he is famous. So I suppose that it would make sense that there would be some statues of Napoleon in London.
I mean, I know about him from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but yeah.
Right!
Piggy. Eating the ice cream, right? Napoleon is someone you would study. If you were studying military strategy, basically bringing in the modern world, we talked about the Napoleonic Code that was mentioned in your quote, and you know, abolished feudalism, separated the church and state, promoted meritocracy, which basically means people who had those skills could lead. This certainly is very much an American situation too, where all of a sudden you're dealing with the everyday person could be a leader as opposed to having a title. This, to me, certainly speaks to the modern world, or at least modern understanding of how society should be set up.
Okay. I buy it, I guess, but I don't know about the hundreds of statues of Napoleon in the city of London. That seems too many to me. But let's get to the real question of this. Does parsley melt into butter?
This actually was a loud moment for me. So when Holmes mentions the dreadful business of the Abernethy family was first brought to my notice by the depth which the parsley had sunk into the butter upon a hot day. Now, obviously, this is one of those wonderful invitations to write fan fiction, right? Write the case of the Abernethy parsley. But at the same time, it's the most outlandish of all the invitations to write fan fiction.
Yes, it is the smallest detail possible. Parsley on butter.
Yeah. Well,
did you do a little detective work, Steve?
I did, and I found that yes, people have done experiments with butter and parsley. Turns out parsley floats, so it doesn't matter. This was a very silly line in this interesting story from Doyle.
Doyle looks over from his dinner dish as he's typing this out and goes, butter. Parsley. All right, we'll put that in there.
Type it up.
So now I was really, you got obsessed with the parsley. I got obsessed with the idée fixe. So this notion, when Lestrade first comes in and says, now this is a case that might be more in Watson's field than Holmes's, because I think we have a lunatic on our hands, and this is a case of monomania. So immediately the word monomania just raises one character for me, which is Melville's Ahab from Moby Dick, which was published in 1855. And Melville actually uses the term monomania in that novel, and he's often referred to as the monomaniacal captain. And so I immediately started thinking about that, and then I realized, wait a minute, do you guys think Doyle read Moby Dick while he was writing The Return of Sherlock Holmes? Because we have that harpooner from Black Peter, right? Which is also the total details about the harpoons, how exactly people use them in the whale hunt. I mean, Moby Dick is a super, super detailed account of whaling. So I started to think, oh no, I myself have an idée fixe about trying to figure out what Doyle was up to. But that idea of having this obsession we now term that obsessive compulsive disorder, but it was called monomania or ED fixe in 19th century psychology.
That's interesting because you're right. We're two short stories away if we go back. So certainly, Moby Dick, of course, just a weekend read because it's so short.
Well, actually, you guys may or may not know that I live really close to Mystic, which has a big Mystic seaport, very famous place where they study all kinds of American sea literature. And once a year on Melville's birthday, there's a 24-hour reading aloud of Moby Dick in which people sit around a circle and take turns reading all the way through.
Can they get through in 24 hours? Wow, that's a pretty amazing. That's a good sized book.
It is a good.
It's a whale of a tale.
A whale of a tale. Dun, dun, dun.
I'll be here all week. No, really, I will be because we're in quarantine.
Try the salmon.
So we see here again Doyle's reaching for creative exclamations. Yesterday we had "By Jove" finally in a Holmes tale, one of the things that I've always credited Holmes with saying all the time, but apparently not so much. Today, Holmes switched it to "By George." Doyle's really making a hobby of these creative exclamations. "By thunder."
Great Caesar's ghost.
Speaking of Ede Fix, you've been looking for this all the way through. I love it.
I've been waiting for "By Jove." I've been waiting for "By Jove" for a while. I always loved teaching that to my students when we got to this. Was, "Oh, by Jove. What's Jove, kids?" And they're like, "I don't know. What's Jove?" I said, "Well, what's jovial?" And they go, "We've never heard that word before." All right, let me explain. Jovial means with joy, like godlike joy. Jove was another name for Jupiter or Zeus. This is by God, but without saying the word God or Jehovah, which you might get in trouble for. Jove, those ancient gods, those are okay to say out loud.
So how are you reading George?
I assume that George is referring to the
George Watson, King. George Jetson, George Washington. Foreman.
Make some salmon. I assume that it's referring to the King George. I don't know. I think that this might be another one of those things that we misheard once, and now we say it all the time in the way that we misheard it. I don't know where George comes from exactly.
Mm. You're correct. I use Great Caesar's Ghost, which is from Superman, or Great Scott. You know, just as a way to say an exclamation. That's right. That's from Superman too.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, this idea of throwing something in there to say your exclamation, maybe to say your curse without using a curse word.
Right. Replacement words. I'm all about replacement words. So we see a very interesting relationship between Holmes, Watson, and the police in this one.
They seem to be buddies.
Yes. Well, and it's funny. Maybe I was thinking because of the same narrative structure, I was thinking of the Blue Carbuncle like 25 stories ago. And Holmes says at the end of that story, "After all, Watson, I am not retained by the police to supply their deficiencies," when he doesn't even let them know about the crime. And wow, things have changed a lot over 25 stories. This time, Lestrade comes in with a case. He says it might not be that interesting to Holmes. But when he gets to the duplicate casts of Napoleon, Holmes perks up. And I love this little exchange between them. Holmes rubbed his hands. "This is certainly very novel," said he. "I thought it would please you," says Lestrade. And so he's like bringing Holmes like something he might enjoy. And after, like much later in the story, Holmes asks Lestrade, "Hey, what are you going to do next?" After they find the murdered man at the third bus. Lestrade tells him, "Oh, here's my plan. Don't you think that's a good plan?" "No doubt. And yet, it is not quite the way in which I should approach the case." And the old Lestrade would have been like, "Well, you do your thing." But this Lestrade says, "What would you do then?" And Holmes says, "Oh, you must not let me influence you in any way. I suggest that you go on your line and I on mine. We can compare notes afterwards, and each will supplement the other." He doesn't say, oh, you do your thing, silly police officer. I will solve the case. He is very kind. He's very gracious to the police. And as when we get to the end of this story, we'll see that even more.
Yeah, it's a big change in their relationship. We have seen their relationship evolve over the course of these stories, and we've gotten to an interesting working together but separate and then comparing notes kind of lifestyle here.
They have a much more mature relationship at this point. Holmes certainly has shown his worth, and Lestrade is more comfortable in his position in, with the police force and recognizing how Holmes can help him.
Even more interesting is Holmes' relationship with the press here. This is definitely Doyle giving his viewpoint on what the press can and can't do for us. We find that Horace Harker is one of the men that bought a bust of Napoleon and his house was broken into, and there's a murdered man on his doorstep, and he is a member of the press, and he's very frustrated by this situation. He says, "I must try and make something of it, though I have no doubt that the first editions of the evening papers are out already with full details. It's like my luck. You remember when that stand fell at Doncaster? Well, I was the only journalist in that stand, and my journal the only one that had no account of it, for I was too shaken to write it. And now I'll be too late with the murder done on my own doorstep." He's a very frustrated writer here.
And he's frustrated by his own like emotional reaction, right? He says, "Oh my gosh, like if I was interviewing someone, I would be able to get all the details out of them, but I'm so like in panic that I can't even remember my own details." And so he's giving us that like eyewitness versus investigator distinction.
Well, it's very hard to remain objective when you're, particularly when you've been shaken. And you can, we're experiencing a little bit of that now with the COVID-19, where people are not, you know, feeling maybe a little anxiety, not easy, and, you know, not focused on how they would normally be focused.
Interesting. Holmes later says to Lestrade, "If you are going back to Pitt Street, you might see Mr. Horace Harker. Tell him from me that I have quite made up my mind and that it is certain that a dangerous, homicidal lunatic with Napoleonic delusions was in his house last night. It will be useful for his article." Lestrade just stares at Holmes here and says, "You don't seriously believe that?" Holmes smiled and replied, "Don't I? Well, perhaps I don't, but I am sure that it will interest Mr. Horace Harker and the subscribers of the Central Press Syndicate." Mwahahaha.
Yeah, so this is the idea of using the press to create a false narrative in order to capture the real criminal. And this is something that we see so much in like detective fiction of the 20th and 21st century. That sort of complex relationship between the press and the police, and the frustration sometimes of the press when they end up getting used to create some sort of sting.
Well, in fact, it just seems like the total public affairs or public relations type of approach to it. And I saw the quote in there. It says, "The press, Watson, is a most valuable institution if you only know how to use it." That just seems like it should be like something up on a blackboard or something like that in an office.
Well, but I think what, a political office, right?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think what Holmes is saying there is not that like the press is the fifth estate that actually like lets people know what's really going on. He's saying, "Oh yeah, I can use the press to do my own work, not to inform people."
It may not be about the truth. It may be how you can spin the truth.
Exactly.
All about that perception, that spin.
Fake news? What? At that time? What's that going? What's going on there?
We get our first Italians, right? These are the first time that we've delved into the country of Italy as a part of Europe. We've got Beppo and his cousin. How much more of an Italian name can we get than Beppo? There seems to be a prejudice here against Italians, right?
Yeah.
This is not a very kind representation.
They are the laborer class in the story, and the mention of the Italian mafia is a prominent part of this conversation.
He was not very progressive here, Steve. Not very progressive at all. But we can understand a little bit of that. In the United States, we have these huge waves of immigrants coming in. We have the Irish wave and the Italian wave and the Jewish people who came in at the time, and how they carved their way into the United States society. But at least initially, they were looked at with some skepticism. But as we learn over time, everyone assimilates. And I'm assuming maybe this was some of the thoughts of the time. Who knows?
It certainly seems to be prejudice. Certainly seems to be a division of us and them here.
Well, it might have been partially based on religion, too. And I can't remember if it's mentioned in the story, but that idea that Italians represent Catholics and there's this schism between different Christian groups. So I don't know. I mean, it is definitely, the representatives of Italian culture here are pretty two-dimensional, right?
I mean, Just a little bit.
Yeah,
they haven't really fleshed out those characters. The Godfather hasn't come out yet. That's the problem.
Right.
And even, like, when I said two-dimensional, I wasn't thinking, of course, we even have the description of the photo, right? It represented an alert, sharp-featured simian man with thick eyebrows and a very peculiar projection of the lower part of the face, like the muzzle of a baboon. And so there's this real, like, animalistic description of Italian man.
And we've seen Doyle use animal description, zoomorphism, so often in these stories.
Oh my goodness, yes.
But calling someone a baboon, to say that this man looks like a baboon, is certainly not a positive thing that he's saying about this man. Everyone who has seen this man or the photo comments on how shockingly ugly this guy is.
I would remember seeing someone this ugly. I didn't see him, says one of the witnesses, right? And he mentions him as both a baboon and later an ape.
Right. And then we have Holmes bounding like a tiger. So we've got, you know, the really beautiful movements of a tiger versus the really not okay movements of an ape, but still fast, still swift and active.
And, you know, and of course, Holmes is a tiger king.
Back to that. Of course. Welcome
but
to 2020.
Lestrade, right? But Lestrade is more obsessed with Beppo's place in the Italian criminal world than Holmes is. Lestrade makes the mistake of being like, oh, this guy's a mafia guy. He's a mafia. He's a member of the mafia. So that's the answer. Whereas Holmes is like, I'm going to keep searching. So there is sort of, Holmes does have a deeper understanding of the situation, of course, than Lestrade, and doesn't simply rely on his ethnic identity to explain the murder.
And this certainly would be a jumping off point to kind of learn a little bit of the history of the mafia. I really didn't even consider that. Although we read a little bit, was it a couple of days ago, we were talking about the World's Fair in Chicago and mafia involvement here. So
Chicago? No. You mean Las Vegas was founded by Chicago? Oh.
There's connections, Steve. Few connections there.
Yeah. So when we get to the ending of this mystery, Sherlock Holmes definitely is going to his flair for the dramatic again, right? This is the Conjurer. He has the sixth Napoleon head brought to his rooms, and with a flourish, he smashes it and finds the object inside that has been the object of Beppo's search.
Vince McMahon could not have done a better reveal here, Steve. This certainly is world wrestling right here. Everyone stand back. Let me bash this thing open for you.
And Lestrade and Watson are sitting there watching this, and they sat silent for a moment. And then, with a spontaneous impulse, we both broke out clapping, as at the well-wrought crisis of a play. A flush of color sprang to Holmes's pale cheeks, and he bowed to us like the master dramatist who receives the homage of his audience. It was at such moments that, for an instant, he ceased to be a reasoning machine and betrayed his human love for admiration and applause. The same singularly proud and reserved nature which turned away with disdain from popular notoriety was capable of being moved to its depths by spontaneous wonder and praise from a friend, Chip.
Well, I was going to say, is that... Was that The Rock or is that Hulk Hogan, Steve? I don't know which one is playing Holmes at that time.
We've talked about his flair for the dramatic, his conjurer act that we saw in the story where he lit a fire in a guy's house just to get him out from his hiding hole. This is Holmes on display.
This is Chris Angel. Which other flaring magician do we know at the time? I mean, certainly.
David Copperfield. I always think of David Copperfield.
Doug Hemmings, too. Oh,
of course. There you go. That's your go-to.
So there is something very laughable about this moment, which we've seen so many times. But I think Watson's not laughing, right? Watson sees that, like, Holmes has this other side to him. He's not just a reasoning machine who can get to the bottom of anything. He also has this need for approval, this need, I would say, for friendship. And then we get to the end of the story, which is really interesting because we've got, again, that relationship changing between Holmes and the police. Well, Lestrade, I've seen you handle a good many cases, Mr. Holmes, but I don't know that I ever knew a more workmanlike one than that. We're not jealous of you at Scotland Yard, no, sir. We are very proud of you. And if you come down tomorrow, there's not a man, from the oldest inspector to the youngest constable, who wouldn't be glad to shake you by the hand. Thank you, said Holmes. Thank you. And as he turned away, it seemed to me that he was more nearly moved by the softer human emotions than I had ever seen him. A moment later, he was the cold and practical thinker once more. Put the pearl in the safe, Watson, said he, and get out the papers of the Cork Singleton forgery case. Goodbye, Lestrade. If any little problem comes your way, I shall be happy if I can to give you a hint or two as to its solution. The end. Now, that final ending, sorry, I read it at such length, that notion of Lestrade really saying, like, Holmes, we're not jealous of you. We just respect you so much. You have earned the respect of every single person at the Yard. And then that notion of Holmes sort of turning away, almost, you can almost picture like a tear in his eye. He needs that approval. And so yesterday I shared with you guys, Jessica Plummer at Book Riot, she just put out this really great blog with the 60 Holmes stories in her order. They're not quite my order, although Jessica and I agree, Hound of the Baskervilles number one. Now, she rated The Adventure of the Six Napoleons a little higher than I would have. She put it at number 10 of the 60. And she says, this is such a fun, goofy little mystery, but the highlight is, of course, Lestrade's speech about how much Scotland Yard respects and admires Holmes, and Holmes becoming overcome with emotion. And I love that section too. I like that humanizing, especially Watson's look at his best friend and being like, this guy does care what we think about him.
Well, in fact, I'm glad you brought that up. When I was reading through that, I didn't really catch it on that level. But you're right. Holmes, it seems like Sherlock Holmes not only is a master detective, he wants to be known as that master detective. He's got that desire to be admired for that. And that is what an interesting insight.
This is the best character development we've gotten from the character of Holmes. Instead of being that machine, that reasoning machine, he is human. He does have feelings.
If only I had feelings, Steve.
I knew you were going to say that. I was feeding you on that one.
That's what good friends do. Holmes. Watson's just sitting there going, oh man, there's going to be this crazy reveal, but it's so important to him. I'm here.
We get the crazy reveal here, but let's be honest. Did you figure out this mystery pretty early in the story?
I did. It wasn't hard. And I don't know if it's because I have seen this in so many, I don't know, pop culture type things, books, cartoons, anything. This was very easy for me to figure out. I'm wondering for a reader at that time if that was as easy to figure out.
Well, I mean, they did have the Blue Carbuncle, which has the exact same idea of someone chasing this unlikely object around town, and they're looking for a gem inside of it, you know? So, yeah, this is a little bit of that College Jeopardy kind of story, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that this was a softball that Doyle was throwing us after all the murder and mayhem and really dark characters doing just awful things to other people. We don't get that in this one.
Well, on some level, you know, if we have 56 short stories, I'm wondering if there are, I don't know, 15 different scenarios it could be, and basically you rewrite them over and over. I'm sure there's some kind of study saying there's only so many types of mysteries.
Didn't we already discuss that, Chip? Didn't you look that up at one point?
Isn't
that
I probably did, Steve. You're assuming I have a memory, and yeah. I don't.
We have discussed this. There are only so many stories that could be told. And yeah, this is one of the ones where a thing is hidden and we have to find it. This is fun, though. I think that we see so many interesting aspects to all these characters, some great character development in this story. I hope that everybody out there is enjoying this as much as we are. And hopefully you're seeing some character development in your maturation process while you're out there, too. If you have feedback, if you want to tell us how you're enjoying these or how you're maturing, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of the feedback from around the world. And don't forget, we're collecting all of these into our website, sherlock.toomuchscrolling.com. That's where you can find all of our Sherlock conversations, as silly as they are. A bunch of silly people discussing literature. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenfly.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
See you in the future.
At least the bicycles.